This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We have some interesting things to look at today, because what comes out of the piece that we'll be learning today is God's expectations from the non-Jewish world. What are they supposed to be doing? I wanted to do a few xeroxes, but the machine is still locked up, so anyway, we'll just go straight into it. We did last week the whole question of dinner. We went into the background and the fact that there was something genetic in her makeup that gave her a tendency to behave the way that she did. Elisa,
morning.
Nice to see you here. It's not Monday night tonight. There was something in her genetic makeup that gave her that tendency. There was something in her experience of childhood. There was the whole issue of her relationship with, or her aborted relationship with Esav, which had an impact on her interaction with Shechem. And yet that doesn't relieve her of responsibility, nor does it relieve Shechem of responsibility. And that brings us back to Linda, I've always said that we should open the shiur to people from Pico Robertson, but I didn't mean that therefore we had to move our people out to Pico Robertson so that there are people from Pico Robertson here. I think you've taken it very literally, and I appreciate it. It's that even though that there were things in her makeup, that doesn't relieve him or her responsibility. Bringing back a point that we've often made, that responsibility does not mean, in responsibility, 100% does not mean that somebody else can't be 100% responsible as well. Responsibility doesn't have to be apportioned. Two people can both be 100% responsible for an act. And that's why that whole debate about is it genetic, you know, is it behavioral, is it environmental, and what is it that really makes people do the things they do, is a very irrelevant discussion. Because the answer is it's all those things. The fact is the way your mother brought you up probably does impact on a whole lot of things that you do, but that doesn't relieve you of any responsibility. It just makes your mother responsible as well. The fact is that your schooling and your background have something to do with the way you act. That doesn't relieve you of any responsibility. It simply makes them responsible as well. The fact that there might be some genetic makeup that causes you to be more aggressive than other people, that might be true, and that means that there is something in your genetic makeup that is responsible, but it doesn't relieve you of any kind of moral responsibility. The only time you are relieved of moral responsibility is if you're doing something which is beyond your control. And that has to be, not that you have a tendency to it, or a drive, or anything like that, but that it's literally beyond your control. Either because you're of unsound mind, and that means absolutely of unsound mind, or because you have been forced to do it by something outside of your own ability to control, and that it's absolute force. Anything other than that leaves us responsible for our choices, even though other people or circumstances might be as responsible as we are. So when the psychologists and psychiatrists get tied up in working out what are the causes for your behavior, it's a lot of wasted time, other than maybe giving you some kind of understanding, because what really has to be dealt with is, having all these forces in you, what made you make that choice? And that's not, I made the choice because of what my mother did to me when I was small. I made the choice because I have a funny gene. That's not so. I had the inclination, I had the desire, I found myself driven that way because of those reasons. But I made the choice because I wanted to. And therefore the issue is, why did you want to, and what are you going to do about it in the future? So the most important part of the work, they often don't get into. And all that they deal with is addressing the other factors that were also responsible. But that doesn't in any way make a difference to addressing our own choices.
Yeah, by they you mean the psychiatrist?
Yes, psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists very often tend to deal with the other forces that cause people to do things, rather than with the fact that those other forces, as responsible as they are, don't make us any less responsible. That's really the important part of it. And that's why the whole discussion on homosexuality is dangerous, because yes, Of course there are people who have a greater tendency towards that than other people, and for them it is harder to resist than it is for other person. But the one person might have a tendency to homosexuality, which is hard for him to resist. Another one might have a tendency to violence, which is hard for him to resist. And a third one might have a tendency to improper sexual conduct, which might be impossible. Each one has his own area where, because of his circumstances and genetic makeup, he finds it difficult. He finds that that's where his area of greatest yetzer hara is. And going into all that is fine. It's okay to figure out why that is your area of difficulty. That's maybe a valid discussion, but it doesn't ease anything. It doesn't mean, and therefore I'm not to blame, and therefore anybody would have done the same thing in my situation. No. Therefore that puts you in a difficult situation, makes the choices very hard, and your character is truly tested in those areas, as opposed to other areas which you find easy, but other people find difficult. The Torah would not place as a mitzvah or an avera, as a mitzvah or a transgression, anything that the human being doesn't have complete control and choice over, irrespective of his genetics and all the other things. Other than a person of an unsound mind, a mad person is relieved of moral obligation. That being the case, let's see how they deal, or how Shem is dealt with. We talked last week about how Dinah was dealt with, or to some degree how she was dealt with, and how she got sucked into this to the point where she didn't want to leave it. She was so engrossed, and how it is possible for a cross-cultural relationship to be so attractive and so wrong. And the fact that it is attractive does not make it right. And the fact that it even works on a kind of a level, because it works for her on a kind of a level, also does not make it right. And the brothers now get involved, the family gets involved. So we're told in 34 verse 5, that's Lamed Dalet Hey, V'Yaakov Shoma Ki Timei Esdino Bito. Yaakov heard that Shem had, and it's interesting a word here, yet it doesn't use the word rape. And we talked about the wording earlier, last week, that he took her, slept with her, and oppressed her in that sequence. And that there actually isn't a word for rape as such in the Torah. But here, it says, and Yaakov heard, what did he do? Timei Estina, he defiled her. Tuma is a spiritual state that has changed. And that was his concern. The rape, okay, so she's been raped. It's a horrible thing. And it's an act of violence, and there should be punishment for it, and all of that kind of thing. But that's all one can deal with. What he's concerned about is the spiritual impact.
Is it the same?
No. Why is it the same?
And it's not a spiritual.
Yes, but what most people are concerned about is not the spiritual impact. They're worried about firstly the physical, and secondly the emotional. What we're talking about is the spiritual, the soul, and the neshama. What does this stand to the neshama? Now, why should it do anything to the soul if she was raped, if she wasn't party to it? Your soul isn't damaged if something happens beyond your control.
But you're still in a situation that normally you would not have been in, that you don't have contact with.
True, but if it's beyond your control, if a person's soul damaged, if he...
Can you just say that people are responsible on some level for what, not the schooling, not their upbringing, I mean, all of that is part of it, but somehow...
Okay, so certainly there was a level of responsibility and choice in her, but pretty minimal when you discuss it. You know, she went out to see the girls, she didn't go to see the boys, and she didn't do a whole lot wrong. On her level, and very subtly, we identified certain things that she was doing incorrectly, but not a whole lot wrong. Where does the concept of tumah, of defiling the soul, of spoiling the soul, of damaging the soul, come at, and that Yaakov's tuning into, where does that really come from?
Soul was defiled.
Tameh is about soul. So Tameh is not about bodies. Tumah is about the soul. It's not about the... Yaakov is worried about her soul, not about her body. That's the issue about the trauma he'll deal with. That's a different issue. But what really hurts Yaakov is that one of the foundresses of the Jewish people has been permanently damaged spiritually. Now, what I'm asking is, spiritual damage is not just a function of contact. What is spiritual damage is a function of soul contact. So what is it that went wrong here? The fact that she wouldn't leave him. Remember last week, the fact that she had to be dragged out, the fact that she enjoyed it, that she found pleasure in this relationship on whatever kind of level. So even that, whether it started as the rape or it started as a seduction and became whatever the various different ways we went through, the fact is there was a connection on some level. That connection destroys her soul. If it was just a violent act of rape for which she felt nothing and she was disgusted and all she wanted to do was get away from him as quickly as possible, that would have been rape. And she would have needed a doctor and a psychologist to help her through it. Yaka's worried that this is much more than rape. She'll get her physical condition will be corrected, but here there's a soul. Here there's a girl who is no longer the naive, pure princess that she was. This is a girl who has been emotionally and spiritually engaged in a relationship that has caused damage to her soul and permanent damage to her soul. And that's why the medics we talked about after, she couldn't fit into to Yaakov's family after that. And that's why she landed up in Egypt and that whole story that followed her according to the some traditions. So this is what's concerning him, that his anger is that Shechem has defiled, that she is spoiled, that she is damaged, that there's a purity problem. Uvonov hoyu es miknehu basode, and his sons were out with the cattle in the fields. Vehecherish Yaakov ad boyam. Yaakov says nothing until the boys come back. Yaakov doesn't deal with this. He doesn't discuss it with anybody. He keeps his sadness to himself. In verse 6, Vayetzach Hamor Av Yishchem, Shechem's father comes to Yaakov to speak to him. At the time that he comes, the sons of Yaakov come from the field, and Hamor doesn't see anything wrong, because in their culture, nothing terrible has happened. The young Jewish girl came for a walk, joined in the dancing, sat down and had a drink with the guys, and one of the guys fell in love with her and took her home, and they've been living together for a little while, and they want to get married. Normal life, normal everyday event in secular society. Nothing wrong with that. So there's such blaziness that Hamor still comes and speaks to Yaakov. You know, wants to discuss it with him. There's no apology. They walk in from the field. They hear what's going on. Va'yitzatzvu ha'anoshim. Interesting the response. What is their response? The first one, look at the emotions here. So interesting. The first emotion is va'yitzatzvu ha'anoshim. What does that mean? Sadness. Grief. There was grief. Just sadness. Vayichal lehem oed, and then there was anger. Not anger first, and sadness out of the anger. The anger was the outcome of the sadness. I'm sad again because there has been spiritual deprivation. There has been spiritual damage, and now I'm angry at he who caused that spiritual damage. The anger is the outcome of the sadness. When anger is the immediate response, then the anger is all sorts of other things, and usually personal. If a person gets angry immediately, he's angry because he's been offended, he's been hurt, he's been damaged. They didn't go through that process. It wasn't that they hurt, got angry. They hurt and got sad. Sadness is not as a result of personal damage. Sadness is you're sad usually for somebody else. You're sad for loss. You're sad for a relationship. A damaged relationship causes sadness. A damaged ego causes anger. They first got sad, then got angry, rather than first got angry and then got depressed. Very, very important to deal with the question. This is a good emotion. That's the order of things. If you get angry and your depression is an outcome of your anger, then the whole thing is caused by your ego, and there's one way to deal with that. If you get sad and anger wells up and builds as an outcome of your sadness, then your issue is a relationship issue, your issue is a connectedness issue, and your anger is an outcome of that. It's not an ego thing. It has to be addressed completely differently. Why? Ki nevolo oso the Yisrael. Because a disgraceful act had been had occurred among Israel. How old was Israel? Third generation. But they've already got a culture, they've already got a value system, they've already got a way of doing things, and it's been shattered. Something has been done that is just not done in among us, where this doesn't happen. Lishka v'sbas Yaakov, to sleep with a daughter of Yaakov, and then three such important words. V'chein lo yase, and that will not happen again. And if you look at the phrasing, if you look at the trope, it's v'chein, it's that emphasis on that v'chein, and this lo yase will not happen. Not should not happen, ought not to happen, will not happen. And that's an important part of what a culture is and what a value system is. When children grow up in a home, when a family grows up, understanding that there are certain things that we just don't do. things that differentiate us. And long before children are even old enough to understand reasons for that, they need to understand what differentiates us. We don't speak like that. We don't use that language. There's a whole lot of stuff that we don't do, whether it's we the Jewish people, whether we as a community, we as a family, whatever it is, that the sense of belonging comes from the everyday actions that they out there do and we don't. And living in a society such as this, that's critically important. Because we're not living in a society that has any such rules. We're living in a society that whose only rule is that there are no rules. And that means that what protects us from that society and our children from that society is not an artificial wall. And there are two ways you can protect it: by have nothing to do with them, they're bad, they're evil, and don't engage with them, or engage with them as much as you want. There's a big world out there, and engage and do what you want. However, there are certain things they do that we don't, and that you need to understand. As long as you've got that clear, you can be free to engage. But I think we're not passing that message on clearly enough, and it's not just a question of religious things that they do and we don't do because we're Jewish and they're not. That's not the issue, because then the child comes back very quickly. My friends at school are Jewish too. My friends are religious. And they use that kind of language, and they talk in that. It's got nothing to do with Jewish religious. It's got nothing to do with that. It's a value system. We don't do that. And the chayim lo yaaseh, this will not happen. But how do you make sure it doesn't happen? It just happened. There's only one way to make sure that it doesn't happen, and that's to make sure that the consequences of this ensure that this never happens again. So what do they do? And Shchamor comes and he talks to them as well, and he says, my son has fallen in love with your daughter, let them get married, and we can marry each other. You're a family living in isolation. Once we've had one such shidduch, you can marry our daughters, we can marry your sons, let's build a society, let's join and make some kind of alliance. Which is perfectly normal, again, for any two families, for any two nations. Be tanu teshevu, you can dwell with us. V'ha'oritz tiyeh lifneichem, the land can be before you. Shvu usacharuha, dwell in the land, do business in the land. V'he'achzu bo, take possession of the land. You're free to live with us as one society. And Shechem then said, no matter what price you want, I'll pay whatever dowry you want, and then there should be no barrier. Just give it to me as a wife. Vayanu b'nei Yaakov et Shechem v'et Hamor aviv b'mirma. Then the Torah is an interesting thing. And Yaakov's sons, now to see the scene, all the sons are sitting there, and Yaakov are sitting there, and Shechem and his father Hamor sitting and discussing the marriage. The sons respond, and they say, the Torah says that the sons of Yaakov answered Shechem and Hamor his father, Ben Mirma. What does Ben Mirma mean? Does that have translated? Deceitfully. Well, how does yours translate it, Mrs. Scott? At the end of verse, in the middle of verse 13? Does it say subtly?
With subtlety.
What does yours say? Is that the same translation? No, before that, in the middle of verse 13.
Is it a disgrace unto us?
No.
We can send unto you?
No, and the sons of Yaakov answered Shechem and Hamor his father. Verse 13.
Just before that.
Two words before that. Subtly, it says also. Mirmo means slyly. And he answered them with slyness. The Unculus translates it. How does Unculus translate it that you've got, Linda? Middle of Yud Gimel. The Chochmah means wisdom. So the word Mirma normally means slyness. Unculus translates it as wisdom. Very interesting, because we'll see what our whole relationship is with slyness. And then it says that the sons of Yaakov answered Shem and his father Hamor, with Mirma, with slyness, translated by Unculus as wisdom, Vayadaberu, and they spoke. Sorry?
Rashi often.
Yes, I'm going to come to the Rashi in a moment. Asher Time is Dino Achosom, because he, and again, what did he do wrong? Not because he raped her, not because he was violent, not because he slept with her, because he damaged her soul. That's the issue here. Now, what's that got to do with the slyness? Rashi here is very important. Rashi says, the Mirma, he quotes Unculus and says, that means b'chokhmah, that means with wisdom, it doesn't mean with slyness. Asher Time. Rashi says an interesting thing here. Hakasuv Omer Shelo Hoso Rumiya. The Torah explains why it wasn't Slinus. Shari Timo is Dina Achosam, because they defiled Dima, because he defiled Dina. What's Rashi explaining? What's Rashi saying? He's saying the word Mirma normally means Slinus. And in terms of strategy, it was a sly strategy. This is now where he's going to say, I want everybody to have a bris, and then on the third day they come and wipe out the city. So it's a sly strategy. Why does Unkelus translate it as wisdom and not as slyness? Rashi says the Torah teaches us that what is wisdom and what is slyness depends on what the intention is. What is a lie and what is truth is not, does not depend on intention. A lie is a lie and truth is truth. What is what is good and what is bad does not, the ends don't justify means. But what is sly and what is wise depends on intention. If you use slyness to achieve justice, because if you don't use slyness, you will be destroyed. That's wisdom. If you use slyness to get something from somebody, to take something from somebody, that's slyness, that's deceit. So mirma is an instrument that the human being is capable of using to mislead his intellectual opponent, and may be used for justice, but may not be used for gain. There are times when you're dealing with a sly person, and the only way you can protect yourself or achieve some level of justice would be through using that slyness. So when an attorney cross-examines a witness, does he use slyness? Or she? Yes, absolutely, because if you don't, you won't get to the truth, because you're dealing sometimes with very sly people. Is that wrong? Is that bad? No, it's not wrong. It's not bad. That is the only way you're going to get to it. And our evil lawyer, who says, I won't be sly, I'm just going to be honest and open and play by the book, he's not going to get justice. It's not going to work out, because you're dealing with sly people. He's dealing with sly people here and realizing the Torah teaches us here the correct usage when slyness may be used. The reason it may be used is because he took the step. He defiled Dina. And there's no way they're going to be able to reason with him, because he sees nothing wrong. As far as he's concerned, there's no problem. He comes and he's talking about marriage and about alliances and about doing things. He doesn't deal with soul issues. He deals with a boy and a girl. He fell in love. What's the big deal? He's not relating to the whole thing on different spiritual levels, which is what Yaakov is relating to it as. So then they say, we can't do this to our daughter, to an uncircumcised man. That's a terrible thing for us. The only way that we can consider that is if you converse, basically. So we're going to want you and your whole society. We're not going to get involved in this. Some of you will be Jewish and some of you won't. It's conversion. You all have a bris. And this is the Chizkuni and others say that they never expected them to agree. And then they would have dealt with it. But they did agree. And he says that the im lotishmu eleinu le'imol, and if you won't all have a bris, we will take our daughter and we'll move on. No, you don't have to convert. But if you want to marry into us, if you want to have these relationships that you're describing, you've got to be Jewish. So make your choice. Vayitvu divrehem b'enei chamor, v'enei shchem ben chamor. And the words were good in the eyes of Chamor and Shchem his son. V'lo eichar hana'a l'aseh tadova. He didn't delay. Ki chofetz v'vat Yaakov, he was so in love. V'hu nichbad mikol b'esov, even him. Shchem was the most highly entitled prince. So they came back to the city, they told the city what's happened, these are good people, they're friendly with us, they want to deal with us. Now, he's a sly politician. Could he not see that there was something up? Did he not question their intention? What was the reason that he didn't? Sorry? Yes. Yeah. His normal, political, analytical, suspicious functions didn't operate. Because if they do operate, nobody would ever get married. If you examine... Nor women, probably. If they really used their full senses and analyzed all the flaws and all the problems and saw everything in a cold analytic life, they would see too many flaws to risk it. The reason that marriage happens is they fall in love, which means they lose their critical faculty, and that's why the only thing to try and watch out for is who you let your children fall in love with, or who you let yourself fall in love with. Because once you've fallen in love, fall is the right word. There is no more ability to stand back and say, this is absurd, this is crazy. That sense doesn't exist, because now you're operating on a different basis. So he senses nothing. He feels nothing. Within a second, he goes, he talks to the people. These are great, wonderful people. We want to do business with them. We want to marry them. And this is what you need to do. You all need to convert. You all need to have a circumcision. And and how does he seduce them? Mikneim v'kinyonim v'chol behemtom. Do you see how wealthy they are? Halalanuheim. It's all going to be ours. All we have to do is have a brit, and they're in the minority. So once they come in, they bring their money. They don't have a vote because they're in the minority. We will outnumber them, but we'll have their wealth. They listened to Shechem and to Hamor and Shechem, and everybody went and had a bris. On the third day, verse 25, when they were suffering pain, third day of an operation, always the most painful, two sons of Yaakov, that's Shimon and Levi, brothers of Dinah, each took their swords, and they came secretly into the city, and they killed every male. Every man in the city they killed. Hamor, Shechem, everybody. And they took Dinah out, dragging her, and the great protest. And they took all their cattle and so on, captured all the women. Vayomer Yaakov, the important verse 30. Vayomer Yaakov el Shimon ve'el Levi. Now, what do we expect Yaakov's response to be? So, what Shimon and Levi have done is, and the plan was all of theirs because they were all present when it happened. This is the difficulty of understanding all of this. The plan was everybody's. Yaakov was present, and the brothers said, "You've got to have a bris." Clearly, they had strategized that. Clearly, they knew what they were doing. It wasn't the real intention. These guys would have a bris, and we would intermarry. That clearly wasn't the intention. So Yaakov must have been party to it. Yet Yaakov then says to Shimon and Levi, "Achartem osi lahavisheni b'yoshvei haaretz." It's a strange thing. You have damaged me and disgraced me in the eyes of the people of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. I'm a small family. They will now gather against me and smite me. And you put us all in danger. We might all be wiped out. And they answered, do you think we will allow our daughter, our sister, to be made into a prostitute? And that's where the story ends. All we know is that much later on, at Yaakov's death, when he gives the blessing, he once again criticizes and almost curses them for what they did. So here we have two poles. We have Yaakov, who remains until the end of his days angry and resentful about what Shimon and Levi did, and we have Shimon and Levi, who are absolutely unrepentant and believe that they did the right thing. That we're not going to allow, and this won't happen again. This was the only way to ensure that it didn't happen again. So we have these two poles. Great authorities. Who are greater authorities than their Yaakov, who should know what's right and wrong? And Shimon and Levi. Great Torah authorities, great originators of our tradition, three generations away from Abraham, children of Yaakov, lived and raised by Yaakov, taught by Abraham and by Yitzchak. What greater people could there be? And here we have a diversity of opinion that is 180 degrees apart, and each remains passionately committed to their view, and there's no apology. Shimon and Levi do not apologize for it. They do not withdraw from it. And Yaakov doesn't concede. Yaakov believes it was wrong. They believe it was right. And the big question is, was it right or was it wrong? What was the basis on which they did it? What is the issue? The issue is not why they killed Shechem. That's easy to understand why they killed Shechem. The question is, why did they kill every innocent man in the city? That is the big issue. And that clearly is Yaakov's issue to have gone in and killed Shechem. That Yaakov would have understood, and maybe that was the intention when they all sat together, that the thought was they would all have a brief, they would all be too weak to resist, and Shimon and Levi would go in and would kill Shechem and maybe Hamor, and that would be the end of it. But that they should wipe out the entire town, that was not the intention, and Yaakov is angry at that. Yes.
I'm wondering if the order of the verses, it says they killed all the males, then it goes back and says they killed Shechem and Hamor. So it almost seems like they went in with the intention
of killing all. Oh, yes, clearly they did. Shimon and Levi clearly did, and that's why they're unrepentant. It wasn't some kind of mistake. Mm-hmm. Their idea was to wipe them all out. That was their strategy from the beginning, but Yaakov seems not to have shared that strategy. So we must assume that Yaakov, while he clearly understood that they were all going to have a brit and that the intention of that was not to marry them, so he clearly understood that there was going to be some bloodshed. Mm-hmm. The only thing we can assume is that he did not understand that they were going to kill everybody, but merely everybody would be weakened so that they would not be able to resist Shimon and Levi coming in with their swords and wiping out the two of them. Now, what we need to look at here, and clearly we're not going to finish this because I want to do a piece of Rambam and a very important piece of Ramban with you, and we'll start it today and we'll finish it, and I'll try and have some Zerach for next week. the Rambam deals with what is expected of the non-Jews. The Rambam says, Al Shisho Dvorim Nitzaveh Adam Harishon. Adam was given six rules, six laws. The first was Avodah Zorah, idolatry. Birkas Hashem, cursing God. Murder. Sexual immorality. Theft. Law, that he has to make laws. Those are the six. And Noach added, to Noach he added Eivir Minachai. Eivir Minachai is to eat meat from an animal that hasn't been killed. That's a kind of barbaric practice that they had at those times. Those are the seven rules of Ben Noach, of universal laws. And then laws were added, he says. When Abraham came, he added the bris and davening shachris. When Yitzchak came, he added on Meiser, taking off the ties, and he added on davening mincha. And when Yaakov came along, Yid HaNoshe, that particular sinew in the meat that we're not allowed to eat, and Ma'ariv was added. And in Egypt, various other mitzvahs were added, and at the time of Sinai, the whole Torah was given. So there was an evolutionary process of the development of laws, starting from Adam until Sinai. But until Avraham, there were seven laws. There were six to Adam, the seventh one to Noah, and those were the only laws until the time of Avraham. If a ben Noach, if a non-Jew serves idolatry, harayu chayev, he's obligated, he's guilty. Now, any of these things, the punishment is death for. So if a non-Jewish person serves idolatry, he's guilty of death. It's a capital offense. Non-Jew curses Hashem, same thing. Non-Jew murders, the same thing. Now, interestingly enough, we did at the breakfast show this morning, the fact that the laws of the rabbis in fact make the Torah easier, not harder. And we gave some examples. The Torah, for example, says, what would be on Shabbos if there weren't laws of the rabbis? The Torah says, you shall not leave your place on Shabbos. If you didn't have the laws of the rabbis, that would mean you can't go out of your house. And that's how the Karaites practice it, because they don't have the laws of the rabbis, so they stay in their houses on Shabbos. It says, you shall not light fires, so the Karaites sit in the dock. They don't use time switches or anything like that, because they don't have the laws of the rabbis. It doesn't explain what meat is kosher. If we didn't have the laws of the rabbis, we wouldn't know why chicken is kosher. So you wouldn't be able to eat chicken if you didn't have the laws of the rabbi. You wouldn't be able to eat meat because you wouldn't know how to slaughter meat. You would be paralyzed, in fact, because the Torah sort of kind of forbids so many things that aren't clear. You wouldn't know exactly what it means, but you would have to forbid a whole lot of unnecessary things if it weren't for the laws of the rabbis. So the Noahide laws don't have rabbinic tradition with them. Therefore, there's no flexibility. So if a non-Jew kills, it's a capital offense, he gets killed. But that means even, he says the Rambam, even Uba Bimeima, even an abortion. If a Jew commits an abortion, it's not a capital offense. So there are certain times when it can be and it can't be and under what circumstances. But even if he does it wrongly, even if there is no justification and a Jew commits an abortion, that is not murder. Because we have a rabbinic tradition that works out what is murder and what isn't, and when is a person and when is not a person. But if you don't have that tradition and you're not allowed to kill, that's why the Catholic Church struggles with abortion. And they're right. If you accept the Torah and you don't accept rabbinic tradition, then abortion is murder. And it's a capital offense. People should be put to death for it. And that's the law. That if a non-Jew, since he does not abide by Talmudic and rabbinic law, only by the Torah's law, the consequence for any form of murder is death. The sexual relations are not permitted. Mother, father's wife, Ashes Ish, a married woman, a sister, a maternal sister, male, homosexuality, and bestiality. Those are the things for which there's capital, there's death. And so he goes on, working his way through all the laws of the Noahide law. Ben Noach, a non-Jew who steals, capital offense. For a Jew, it's not a capital offense. Turn the theft and double the theft and all sorts, but that's all in the Gemara, it's not in the Torah. So if you're following the Torah's Noahide laws, theft is forbidden. If you do it, capital offense, you don't have a right to live. And now what does theft mean? Theft means not paying a worker on time. A person comes and does a job of work for a non-Jew, and that night the worker is not paid, that's capital offense, because he has stolen. A worker who takes more than his lunchtime off is stealing wages from his master, capital offense. Imagine what an economy we would have if that was the case. So lack of productivity, taking advantage, exploitation of people, whether it's the worker exploiting the boss or the boss exploiting the worker, capital offenses, all part of theft. So the Noahide laws are terribly strict because they don't have rabbinic flexibility. What about laws, the mitzvah to make laws? Says the Rambam the following, Chayovin lo hashiv dayonim v'shotim b'chol plach u'plach. They are obligated by Noahide law to establish courts of law in every town. V'ladun b'shesh mitzvahs elu, and to judge these six laws. That's what they're going to stop people stealing, they're going to stop people doing all these things. And l'ulahazir esu'am, and they've got to teach the nation and warn them and legislate so that the nation doesn't commit any of these transgressions. Uven Noach she'avar al achas misheva mitzvahs elu, and then Ben Noach who's transgressed any of these mitzvahs, ye hareg b'sayif, gets guillotined, he gets killed by the sword. And then he adds, Upim pnei ze nitchayvu kol ba'alei Shechem hariga, and that's why all the inhabitants of Shechem were killed. What did they do wrong? What was their sin? They're Noachites, so what did they do wrong? The people of the city. What is the Rambam telling us?
Because they didn't do anything about what had
happened. Yes, absolutely. They were not keeping up the legal system. And that's one of the Noahide laws. So like any other Noahide law, you're guilty of death for not doing that thing. One of the Noahide laws is keep law and order. And part of keeping law and order is punishing offenders. And since Shechem, just because he was the king or whatever it was, wasn't brought to trial and punished for that, the people were held culpable. So they were responsible for that. Now, what did Shechem do that was not against the Noahide laws? She wasn't married. She wasn't anybody's sister or brother. She had no relationship. What did Shechem do that was against the Noahide laws? Again, the Noahide laws are idolatry, cursing God, theft. Yes, absolutely. Says the Rambam, Shehare Shechem gozal. Shechem stole. Stole. It was thieving. It wasn't sexual immorality. He stole.
An idea of what stole was.
Yeah, but it's not so much the stealing the soul, and he's right that that's the outcome, but he stole the woman. You stole her heart, he stole her mind. It's theft. Unbelievable concept, the Rambam says. Seduction is theft. You've taken away something that doesn't belong to you. She did not make these choices out of in her normal situation, in her normal. This is theft. You've taken her away from her family, you've taken her away from her culture, and yes, you've damaged her soul, although you might not have known that. But certainly there's been theft. You've taken something that doesn't belong to you. You've taken something you had no right to. You wanted to marry her, go and talk to the father first. Don't come afterwards, mess her up, and then come to the father and say, now I want to marry her. You've messed her already. And that's theft, that's damage. V'heim ro'u v'yodu. And they saw and knew. V'lo yedonuhu, and they never judged him. They never held him accountable. They never punished him. And therefore, Shechem, the nation, the town of Shechem, never punished the prince for doing what they knew was wrong. The fact is they stole the person. So it's not because of sexual impropriety. That's not the issue, because there wasn't a forbidden sexual relationship. So they didn't get married first. Okay, big deal. That's not the issue. The issue is you had no right to this. This is something that didn't belong to you. You had no right to this. The nation knew that, and the nation should have taken action. And that's what...
I mean, you implied last week that there was seduction, and beyond a certain point, she was actually so why are we blaming him if she was
part of the conflict? That's a good question, and the answer you won't like.
I don't know,
I'm not. How do I know? I'm using Carmel's methodology from yesterday. How shall I put it? In the man-woman sexual relationship, the man is far more responsible than the woman. And that seduction, it is much easier. When a man is seduced, there is consent. When a woman is seduced, there is not. The woman often wakes up the next morning and says, why did I do that? The man doesn't. The man says, yeah. And there is a responsibility that the man has with a woman, that a woman has less of. And that was the theft. He stole her ability to say no, he stole her thought process, he stole her conscience. He put her into a position through all the seduction process that we discussed that deprived her of that free will.
Good.
Rabbi? Yes, Carl? Well, certainly not the traditional Jewish way of doing it, where the whole thing is set up beforehand. There's agreement before they even meet. And now all that has to happen is that the two like each other. At that way, so that kosher way, I'm not saying it's a way that works today because we've got a whole lot of other problems to why, but in the pure kind of environment where two families knew each other and know each other and the kids come from the same kind of background and the two parents get together and say, wouldn't it be nice if our kids got married? Do you have any objection? Not at all. Lovely kids, let them meet and talk about it. Tell the kid, I have no objection if you do. Why don't you two go out and see? That's not tested. Absolutely no test about that. And likewise, even if it's not quite so contrived, but kosher, there's very little. The point at which it becomes theft is when there's physical contact. That's the point. Physical contact or alcohol are the two things that deprive the woman of her sanity. And that's why the laws are so strict. That's why that, you know, what they now call the Bli Yadayim law. Don't touch, because it's not fair. Once you've touched, you've stolen. And if a relationship, a boy and girl go out and don't touch until they've decided to get married, there isn't theft. And if they do, then you're right. Yes, they could be there. And there often is, and maybe that's why there are a lot of, or partially why there are a lot of chance, right?
Well, in secular law, there's a distinction between stealing personal property or even real property, real estate. But it is a thing. It is an object. And that is an entire body of law distinct and separate from laws that involve injury to the person.
Right.
There is a line that's drawn. The theft that you're talking about here seems to merge. It doesn't draw lines.
Right.
So
the Ramban is walking dangerous territory, and the Ramban is going to question him next week. And we're going to have to look at this whole thing. But the Ramban is being very innovative in trying to understand it and is creating a new area of law, you're quite right, and saying that that area of law is not just material property. And I think that secular law is beginning to struggle with the boundaries when it gets onto intellectual property. The theft of things you cannot touch and cannot define that easily, and it's much more part of the body of a person, part of something inside the person. And I think that the law is struggling with those definitions, and when it is and when it isn't. And this goes much further than that, and says you can steal a person's conscience, you can steal a person's ability to discern. Drug dealing, drug pushing, should be banned on this basis. Not because it's a harmful substance and all the rest of it. You are depriving, by giving a person that drug, you are depriving that person of the ability to say yes or no to a whole lot of other issues. So yes, it is the creation of a new field of law that not only don't other bodies of law recognize, but even the Ramban is going to have difficulty within Jewish law as to whether that's a valid reason for what happened.
Well, it would appear so.
Even if she was just responsible for going there, she would then be held responsible for knowing the dangers. So you see a party of people having a good time. What you know is you mustn't land up with those people. So now what do you do? There's only one thing to do, and does that limit you and restrict you and all of this? Yes, it does. You don't go to the party. And does that make you narrow in that area? Yes, it does. But it leaves you free to make choices. Going to the party makes you broad-minded. I now have no ability to say yes or no, and therefore I have so again, it's like our discussion yesterday of whether that's a definition of broad-minded or not. But yes, it would require of her to say, I would love to go to those girls, I'm having such a good time dancing, the music's lovely, the dancing's lovely, but I can see what's going on there. So let me stand and observe for a little. I can see what's going on there. They're not just dancing, they're drinking as well, and although they're only girls, they're boys standing over there, and I just shouldn't be there, because I know where it needs to lead to. The only natural place to say no is here. And that would be what she was held accountable for.